Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this next half-hour segment, we're going to be continuing with a reading of a very, very important article from the July 1997 issue of the Atlantic Monthly. This article is entitled The Widening Gap Between the Military and Society, and has been subtitled, Today's Fragmented Society is at Odds with the Classic Military Values of Sacrifice, Unity, the Interests of the Unity, Self-Discipline, and Considering the Interests of the Group Before Those of the Individual. And indeed, I think the pressures described in this particular article, both the downsizing of the military in the wake of the Cold War, producing greater strain on the military's ability to provide for the dependents of professional soldiers and sailors and airmen, the fact that the military is now more than a quarter of a century past conscription, there's no more draft, the fact that a growing number of officers see the military as more exemplary of the values of traditional American values than civilian society. And I think ultimately the pressures that could be brought about by an economic failure and resulting political catastrophe could exacerbate this gap between the civilian and military sectors and potentially in a disastrous fashion. Also note that there are indications that the post-Cold War military may become more of a garrisoned organization, basically confined to posts, and that the traditional American phenomenon of a disproportionately large Southern representation of the military also bears upon this. And at the time of World War I, for example, 90% of Army generals had a, quote, Southern affiliation, unquote. Well, it's not that extreme today. Still, there's a long tradition in the American South of men making a career of the military, and white Southerners and white Southern males in particular are disproportionately represented in the military. We're going to begin at the top of the paragraph with which I concluded this the first half-hour segment. Again, officers today appear to be not only more conservative than those in the past, but also more active in politics, both in how they describe themselves and in how they vote. This change is all the more striking because traditionally the American military has avoided political involvement. After the Civil War, Huntington wrote in The Soldier and the State, quote, not one officer in 500, it was estimated, ever cast a ballot, unquote. In Once an Eagle, 1968, an illuminating novel about the 20th century U.S. Army, Anton Meyer, M-Y-R-E-R, has his young hero tell a congressman, quote, when I serve my country as a soldier, I'm not going to serve her as a Democrat or as a Republican. I'm going to serve her as an American, unquote. But military personnel have for the past decade been voting in greater percentages than the general population. In his survey of Marine officers, Newton found that, quote, although the majority of the officers did not believe the military should play an active role in political decisions, a significant minority did believe such activity was appropriate, unquote. It's worth noting that the past two chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff have entered election year debates on issues touching on the military. During the 1992 election, General Colin Powell twice spoke out against military intervention in Bosnia, which candidate Bill Clinton was proposing. Less noticed, Powell's comparatively retiring successor, General John Shalakashvili, spoke out during the 1996 presidential primary season against isolationism and anti-immigrationism, two issues the Republican candidate Pat Buchanan was promoting. An odd little book titled Clint McQuaid, U.S. Marine Corps, The New Beginning, 1990, is perhaps unintentionally revealing. Reading this novel, which was privately published by the author, Gene Duncan, D-U-N-C-A-N, a retired Marine major, feels like taking a spelunking trip through the collective unconscious of the Corps. Indeed, Duncan states at the outset that any resemblance to real people, quote, springs from my subconscious over which I have no control, unquote. The book is about a retired Marine master gunnery sergeant who was reborn with the body of a 16-year-old while retaining the knowledge, memories, and experiences of his old self. He eventually, of course, joins the Marines. The book is most interesting for what it asserts as a matter of course, essentially that American society is decaying, corrupted, misled by its elected officials, and deserving of resentment from the Marines who protect it. Quote, Americans are selfish people, the hero explains to his buddies. Later he tells them, quote, I think I have lost all faith in our politicians, so I take the narrow view and confine it to those around me of like mind, minds which dictate unselfishness and honor, unquote. But add, too, I feel some of the same sense of alienation from the rest of society as well. I think some of the points that are being made here by these conservative officers should be considered by the people in the civilian sector, who, in my opinion, are corrupt and very selfish, ego-oriented, and frankly, un-American or anti-American in their selfishness and their hedonism. Continuing. In a postscript, the author says that his, quote, purpose in writing, unquote, has been to, quote, give the reader a sense of the heart of the United States Marine Corps, unquote. He explains that he has tried to show the Marines to be, quote, special people with special hearts who serve a seemingly ungrateful nation, unquote. The novel shows part of the military talking to itself when it doesn't think it's being overheard. Though hardly famous in the outside world, Gene Duncan is well known within the Marines. His books are sold by the Marine Corps Association, which at its Quantico bookshop has a special Duncan's Books area. The 1991 edition of General Military Subjects, the textbook used to train all recruits at Parris Island, quotes Duncan on its inside cover as saying that the job of a drill instructor is to undo, quote, 18 years of cumulative selfishness and me-ism, unquote. Just after the table of contents, the textbook gives Duncan a full page. The only other person to be so honored in the entire 199-page textbook is President George Bush. These isolating attitudes, while perhaps most extreme in the Marines, are also found in varying degrees elsewhere in the military. Quote, there is a deep-seated suspicion in the U.S. military of society, unquote. Andrew Bacevich, or Bacevich, B-A-C-E-V-I-C-H, a retired Army colonel who is the executive director of the Foreign Policy Institute at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, told me in an interview. It is, quote, part of the Vietnam hangover. You guys betrayed us once and you could do it again, unquote. This suspicion, he added, isn't going away. It's being transmitted to a new generation of officers. Here again, the long-term consequences of the end of conscription are still unfolding. It has become easier for the middle class in general and liberals in particular to follow their traditional impulse to turn away from the military. Within the military, the end of the draft has also meant the end of its leavening effect. People from non-military families were conscripted or spurred by the draft to enroll in ROTC, R-O-T-C, the Reserve Officer Training Corps, and found that they actually liked military life. General Powell, for example, came from a non-military background and attended the distinctly non-military City University of New York. General Shalakashvili was a draftee. In some years of the early 1990s, the Joint Chiefs contained more members who had come out of public universities than members who had gone the traditional routes of West Point, Annapolis, and the Air Force Academy. But the generation of draft-era officers is now retiring, and it is a virtual certainty that in 20 years the chairman of the Joint Chiefs will be a volunteer. All this will make it easier for the military and the liberal professionals of the middle class to look upon each other with contempt. It is one matter to acknowledge that much in American society today is deserving of contempt. It is another matter to propose that the role of the U.S. military, especially an all-volunteer professional military oriented toward conservative republicanism, is to fix these problems. Yet, that is what some are doing. Quote, it is no longer enough for Marines to reflect the society they defend, Michael Wiley, W-Y-L-Y, a retired colonel advised in the March 1995 issue of the Marine Corps Gazette. Again quoting, they must lead it, not politically, for culturally, for it is the culture we are defending, unquote. In some ways, this is nothing new. The military can be seen as just reverting to its pre-Second World War and pre-Cold War stances, socially isolated, politically conservative, and working primarily on bases in the South and the West. In The Professional Soldier, Janowitz wrote, quote, military ideology has maintained a disapproval of the lack of order and respect for authority which it feels characterizes civilian society. In the past, most professional soldiers even felt that the moral fiber of American manpower was, quote, degenerating, unquote, and might not be able to withstand the rigors of battle, unquote. There are two important differences between today's military and the military before the Second World War. First, it is far larger, some six times the size of the 244,000-man active duty military in 1933. Over the same period, the U.S. population has merely doubled in size. Second, it is frequently used as an instrument of national policy, as it was with the recent large deployments to Somalia, Haiti, and Bosnia. Possibly a third major difference is its quality. For the first time in the nation's history, the U.S. military is generally regarded as the best in the world. If, as now appears likely, it is cut significantly over the next 10 years, frustrated officers may be more politically direct in expressing their resentment than they were in the past. It would be surprising if all were to adopt the stance of General Omar Bradley, who, in a passage quoted by Janowitz, commented, quote, 32 years in the peacetime army had taught me to do my job, hold my tongue, and keep my name out of the papers, unquote. There is widespread agreement that over the past few decades, American society has become more fragmented, more individualistic, and less disciplined, with institutions such as church, family, and school wielding less influence. Whatever the implications of these changes, they put society at odds with the classic military values of sacrifice, unity, self-discipline, and considering the interests of the group before those of the individual. The split is all the deeper because the military has effectively addressed the two great plagues of American society, drug abuse and racial tension, but civilian society has not. In addition, the military is doing a better job in other areas where society is faltering, including education. The Army especially has done well with the growth of realistic training at facilities such as the National Training Center, the Joint Readiness Training Center, and the Combat Maneuver Training Center, where soldiers live in the field and conduct bloodless battles against well-trained opponents. Younger enlisted soldiers and Marines frequently exude an air of competence that is rare in today's 18- and 19-year-old civilians. Local military recruiters report that they no longer recruit from certain high schools because so few of the graduates of these schools are able to pass the military entrance examination, the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery, a simple test of reading, writing, and arithmetic skills. The result of this selectivity is that the military is now far better educated than the general population. About 96% of recruits in 1995, for example, earned high school diplomas as compared with 79% of civilians aged 18 to 24. Indeed, about 40% of all officers now hold postgraduate degrees. The end of the draft has altered the way society looks at the military. Charles Moskos, M-O-S-K-O-S, traces the American people's supposed intolerance of casualties to the end of the draft because the elites aren't putting their own offspring in harm's way. The American people mistrust they're sending everyone else's children into battle. I disagree with this analysis and am instead persuaded by the explanation put forward by James Burke, B-U-R-K, a professor of sociology at Texas A&M University, that the American people will not tolerate casualties when they dislike a policy or don't understand it, as was true with Somalia. But I think Moskos is pointing in the right direction. American political and economic elites generally don't understand the military. A comment published this spring in the Utney Reader, the Reader's Digest of the New Age crowd, captured the disdain for today's military. In an editorial introduction to an article, the magazine stated that in light of the Tailhook and Aberdeen scandals, quote, it's hard to imagine why any woman or any man with a conscience would want to join the military, unquote. Nor is such understanding deemed important even in making national security policy. Consider, for example, the conspicuous lack in the White House of staff members with military experience in an administration that has proved to be militarily activist. Even after bungling an inherited mission in Somalia and then using U.S. forces to feed Rwandan refugees, invade Haiti, and enforce a peace agreement in Bosnia, the Clinton administration did not see fit to follow a Pentagon suggestion that it appoint someone with a military background to a senior post on the National Security Council. Misunderstanding the military is dangerous for both the military and the civilian population. Nowadays, I think, policy members tend to overestimate what the military can do. It isn't clear, for example, just how the Clinton administration expects the appointment of a four-star general, Barry McCaffrey, as drug czar to revitalize its efforts against drugs. Overestimating the military is probably even more dangerous than believing that it is made up of incompetent buffoons, as baby boomers seemed to believe in the 1970s. An uncertain grasp of military affairs is likely to characterize policymaking for the foreseeable future. As recently as during the Vietnam War, two-thirds of the members of Congress were veterans. Today, almost two-thirds are not. What most congressmen know of the military is what they saw on television during the Gulf War. They learned two lessons: high-tech weaponry works, and the United States needs missile defenses. Partly because the Army effectively blacked out media coverage of its Gulf War triumph, Congress came away with little interest in training, personnel issues, or ground forces in general. It should have been no surprise to the military that after the Republicans won a majority in Congress in 1994, they advocated missile defenses and B-2 bombers while trying to cut military pensions. In March of last year, several younger members of Congress formed the Republican Defense Working Group, which they said would, quote, scour the defense budget for savings, unquote. As Andrew Bacevich has observed, it'll be interesting to see how the political beliefs of the officer corps change when officers realize that to be conservative is no longer necessarily to be in favor of defense spending. But the most salient point is that Congress isn't particularly interested in defense issues. This isn't a matter of ideology. Even before the Republican victory, the armed services committees were declining in prestige. Mainly because of the post-Cold War reduction in military budgets, defense is an unpleasant issue for members of Congress. Several rounds of base closings have made membership on the Armed Services Committee something of a liability. As one congressional staff member told me several years ago, quote, back home they'll ask, if you're on the committee, why couldn't you do something about it, unquote. Among the congressional freshmen elected to the House in 1992, 19 requested seats on the Science and Technology Committee, historically a backwater, whereas only 7 asked for armed services. The next section is entitled Changes in the Security Environment. With the evaporation of the Soviet Union, many Americans don't understand why the nation needs a large standing army. For the first time in its history, with the possible exception of the 2 decades preceding the Spanish-American War, the U.S. Army must justify its existence to the American people. Again, this suggests that the Army will become more like the Marines, small, expeditionary, and for the good of the institution, better at explaining itself to Congress and the media. Peacetime trends in American civilian-military relations already point toward huge budget cuts in the coming years. Last year, for example, Peter DeFazio, a Democratic congressman from Oregon, proposed reducing defense spending to $210 billion in 2001 from the current $263 billion. The Electronic Industries Association in 1995 forecast a 2005 defense budget of $214 billion. The Army is likely to suffer a disproportionate share of the cuts, and most of the cuts will be aimed at personnel rather than at procurement or operations and maintenance. Also, with the end of the Cold War, the military's definition of the, quote, threat, unquote, went up for grabs. Everybody used to agree that it was the Soviet Union. Now there was a lot of talk in the military, especially in the Marines, that the new threat is chaos. Sergeant Darren Carey, C-A-R-E-Y, a drill instructor for Platoon 3086, the unit I followed home from Paris Island, taught the platoon that, quote, today the threat is the low-intensity things, the 9-1-1, that you never know what's going to happen. It's Bosnia, Haiti, Somalia, unquote. He told me that he also teaches that the threat is, quote, the decline of the family, the decline of morals, unquote. As his comment indicates, it is easy to blur the line between foreign and domestic enemies. I think this haziness may already be occurring on an institutional scale with the Marines, for whom the Los Angeles riots of 1992 were a preamble to the Somalia deployment later that year. From a military perspective, the operations were similar. In both cases, Marine combat units based in California were sent to intervene in fighting between armed urban factions. Quote, as soon as we got to Mogadishu, we were struck by the similarity to L.A., unquote, one Marine colonel involved in both operations told me. Some of the lessons learned by the Marines in Los Angeles are worrisome, especially when seen in the context of a strongly conservative, politically active military. Marine Major Timothy Reeves argued in a paper written at the Marine Command and Staff College that because of, quote, the rising potential for civil disobedience within the inner cities, unquote, it is, quote, inevitable, unquote, that the U.S. military will be employed more often within American borders. The trouble, he said, is that a variety of U.S. laws inhibit the execution of domestic missions. In Los Angeles, Reeves said, when faced with a choice between violating doctrine and violating federal law, some Marines chose the latter course, detaining suspects and conducting warrantless searches. Similarly, Marine Captain Guy Miner, M-I-N-E-R, reported in a 1992 issue of the Marine Corps Gazette that Marine intelligence units were initially worried by the need to collect intelligence on U.S. citizens in ways that would violate a 1981 executive order, but that, quote, this inhibition was quickly overcome as intelligence personnel sought any way possible to support the operation with which the regiment had been tasked, unquote. Reeves called for major alterations of U.S. law to enable the Marines to execute these new domestic missions just as they execute missions abroad. Changes that could carry long-term consequences for U.S. civilian-military relations. Experience from the Los Angeles riots, he said in his paper, demonstrated the need to grant U.S. Marine Forces the legal right to detain vehicles and suspects, conduct arrests, searches, and seizures in order to accomplish the peacekeeping mission, unquote. The Los Angeles mission also demonstrated a need for the Marines to coordinate terminology with the police. When police officers asked some Marines to cover them while they confronted an armed suspect barricaded in his residence, Reeves reported the Marines shot approximately 30 rounds of what they call covering fire into the building before the police stopped them. In a December 1994 article in the Marine Corps Gazette, William S. Lind, a military analyst who has been influential in the doctrinal thinking of the post-Cold War Marines, wrote with two Marine reservists that American culture is, quote, collapsing, unquote. Starting in the mid-1960s, we have thrown away the values, morals, and standards that define traditional Western culture. In part, this has been driven by cultural radicals, people who hate our Judeo-Christian culture. Dominant in the elite, especially in the universities, the media, and the entertainment industry, now the most powerful force in our culture and a source of endless degradation, the cultural radicals have successfully pushed an agenda of moral relativism, militant secularism, and sexual and social liberation. This agenda has slowly codified into a new ideology, usually known as multiculturalism or political correctness, unquote, that is, in essence, Marxism translated from economic into social and cultural terms, unquote. Little is remarkable about that paragraph, which reads like standard right-wing American rhetoric of the 90s, not all that different from Pat Robertson or Pat Buchanan. Its significance lies in the conclusion that Lind and his co-authors drew, quote, "The next real war we fight is likely to be on American soil," unquote. As a coda, retired Marine Colonel Wiley wrote a few months later in another Gazette article, quote, "We must be willing to realize that our real enemy is as likely to appear within our borders as without," unquote. He then took swipes at the two fundamental principles of U.S. military professionalism, unwavering subordination to civilian control, and non-participation in politics. Quote, "If our laws and self-image of our role as military professionals do not allow for the recognition that the real enemy may be within, we need to change them," Wiley, unquote. Wiley raised the possibility that the Marines would refuse to enforce certain laws. Specifically, if Congress were to restrict gun ownership, then Marines would need to understand that, quote, "enforcing such a restriction could quickly mean make us the enemy of constitutional freedom," unquote. To its credit, the Gazette carried in the same issue a common-sense response to the Lind article from Major Mark Bean, who wrote, quote, "America is made of tougher stuff than the authors would have us believe," unquote. When the military is politically active, when it believes it is uniquely aware of certain dangers, and it discusses responding to domestic threats to cherished values, then it edges toward becoming an independent actor in domestic politics. A classic example of this situation happened in Chile, Major Robert Newton warned at the conclusion of his report, the politicization of the officer corps, unquote. Again quoting, "The Chilean military was a very professional organization. The majority of the officer corps came from the middle class. When the society elected a communist president, the military broke from society. The officer corps believed this change threatened the basic principles upon which the society rested," unquote. And the conclusion of the article is what must be done, and it reads, "A U.S. military coup remains extremely unlikely. Samuel Huntington seems closer to the mark when he attributes the civilian military turbulence of the Clinton administration to the process of seeking out a new post-Cold War equilibrium in the civilian-military relationship. But not all equilibriums are equal. The United States may be in danger of drifting into a situation in which the military is neither well understood nor well used, and yet, as was not true in previous areas of military estrangement, is big, politically active, and frequently employed on a large scale to execute American foreign policy. The development of the semi-autonomous military described by the Harvard political scientist Michael Desch isn't healthy in a democracy. In addition, it isn't clear that the U.S. military, for all its political military expertise, is best placed to decide how it should be used either at home or abroad. However ignorant of military affairs the Clinton administration may be, its estimate of the human costs of invading Haiti appears to have been far more accurate than the Pentagon's. Similarly, 16 months into the Bosnian deployment, none of the military's grim warnings that the U.S. military would suffer widespread casualties as it became entangled in a guerrilla war had been realized. This is a testament in part to the professionalism of today's soldiers. But it should also suggest that future Pentagon estimates of the human costs of possible operations deserve to be viewed with great skepticism. Mutual distrust between the nation's political elites and military leaders could ultimately undercut U.S. foreign policy, making it more difficult to use force effectively. Indeed, this unease may in part explain why the Army was reluctant to take a more activist stance in the Haiti and Bosnia missions and instead fretted publicly about, quote, mission creep, unquote. To begin to repair the relationship, several steps could be taken. First, consideration should be given to reinstating some form of a draft. Along the lines of the current German system, youths could be given the choice of performing, say, 18 months of military service or 2 years of public service. But the resumption of conscription appears unlikely for the foreseeable future, so several other steps should be considered in order to engage the military with civilian society. ROTC programs should be vastly expanded, especially at elite institutions. The service requirement attached to attending one of the three military academies might be shortened in order to encourage more military officers to pursue careers in civilian society. Among other things, this might eventually lead to the presence in Congress of more people with military experience. Whenever possible, military officers pursuing higher degrees should be sent to civilian universities, whether or not this means closing some military schools. As Elliot Cohen, a military strategist at Johns Hopkins, who is one of the more thoughtful commentators on U.S. civilian-military relations, has suggested, there may even be ways of bringing people into the military later in their lives, possibly at ranks as high as lieutenant colonel. And the military could use the skills of reservists far more imaginatively, especially in an era when civilian technologies are outpacing military ones. To help recruiters draw from the other end of the socioeconomic scale, retired Admiral Stanley Arthur suggests that the military establish special preparatory programs that would enable more inner-city youths to enlist. But the most important change that should be made involves the military only secondarily. This concerns the isolation of professional Americans or the upper middle class from the broad concerns of society. Ignorance of the military, I think, is just one manifestation of that larger problem. We live in an era when a Democratic president sends his child to private school and a few eyebrows are raised. America's military problem is not unlike that facing parts of the former Soviet Union. In reviewing the depredations of semi-autonomous or fully autonomous militias in 31 new states and, quote, mini-states in the old Eastern Bloc and the former Yugoslavia, Charles H. Fairbanks, Jr., an expert on post-communist transitions, recommended that in order to assert public control over these forces, quote, it is particularly important to involve the new middle class in military service, unquote. America would do well to take the same advice. And that concludes this article from the July 1997 issue of the Atlantic Monthly, The Widening Gap Between the Military and Society by Thomas E. Ricks. And that concludes this particular half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.